Thank you for listening to the Keystone Church podcast. For more information about us, you can visit us at mykeystonechurch.com. So we're going to continue today on the secrets of the storm. And so last week, we talked about the idea that the first thing our tendency is to do in a storm is to find someone to blame and to try to figure out who's responsible and how unhealthy and unhelpful that question can be as the first one to ask. And that the most important thing really is that we begin our process when we're in a time of turmoil or struggle with the question of how are we going to get through this? How are we going to get through this? Who are we going to get through this with? Because if we don't know how we're going to get through this, then the storm itself is going to be responsible for our end point, our end destination. But if we decide how we're going to get through it, if we decide that we're going to walk through something with Jesus, that is going to make so much more difference than having a knowledge of who's responsible, who caused this, why am I here? It's not that that's a bad question. It's that often we ask the question, who's responsible, with the intent of finding someone to blame, but it's not actually a productive healing part of the process. And sometimes that's an answer we don't get. Sometimes we don't find out who is to blame. Sometimes things happen. So today, I want to dig a little bit more into that second question, being who's responsible for the storm? Because I think there's several different things that can cause storms of trial or turmoil or pain or struggle that we go through. And so it is important for us to have at least the question of, like, am I responsible for this? Is this something that the enemy has done? Is this just a natural life thing that happened? So, I mean, I do think it's important to ask that question. Like I said last week, I don't think it's the most important question, but it is an important part of the process. And I think generally the biggest cause of storms are either storms that we have caused through our actions or through something that we've done, storms that the enemy has caused through attack, and then natural storms that just kind of occur as a part of life. I think when we talk about those, the one that may feel like it's a glaringly being left out is, does God cause storms in our lives? Does God cause storms in our lives? And I think that's an important question to ask, because I think that God does allow us to go through times of teaching and times of testing. I think that God is the kind of God who loves us enough to teach us things that are difficult, and sometimes to help establish and root those things in us by allowing us to go through things. But I want to be clear, I don't believe that God creates evil in order to test us. His tests are usually gentle. They're often difficult, but tender. There's a gentleness. When God is walking us through something or teaching us something, I don't believe that he's the kind of God that's going to use massive tragedy or pain or sorrow, that he's going to be the author of those things. I don't think that's how he operates. And when we look at the nature and the character of God, we have to remember, and I've talked about this before, the idea that God is not actively in control of every detail of everything that's happening on the earth. We can't attribute the horror of child trafficking to God. We can't attribute the tragedy and the horror of cancer to God putting that inside of people, into their lives. That's not the nature and the character of our God. And to demonstrate that a little bit, 1 Corinthians 14:33 says, God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. And yet we know that there is confusion, that confusion does exist, but it's saying he's not the author of it. 2 Peter 3:9 says, God wills that none would perish, but all would come to repentance. And yet we know that some do perish. So again, we've talked about this idea before, but God is not actively getting his way in everything that happens on the earth. He is not willing that any should perish, and yet we see that some are. In Psalm 115, it says, the highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to mankind. So we have a responsibility here on the earth to partner with God for his way, for his will. But we don't always see it happening. One last piece of this is James 1, verse 13 says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. And what's interesting is the word tempt, if you look in the Greek, it's peirazo. And what it means is to examine, to submit another to a test, to learn the true nature of, or the character of, or to try to trap or attempt to catch. So in other words, God is not the one who's trying to trap us or catch us in the act. He's also not using tragedy to try to tempt us or to try to test our character. That's not the nature of the God that we have. He is in charge, but he's not in control. So when we look at the storms and the different causes, the first cause I want to talk about is storms that we created. There's storms that we go through as a result of our own actions, as a result of our own mistakes. Sometimes we did it. And when that's the case, we have to be reestablished in our identity before we can address what led us to that point. And often, I don't know about you guys, but when we're in a self-caused storm, I find the voice of the enemy is not far behind. And, you know, it's this voice in the back of your head of, you done messed up, Aaron. And it's that voice of shame, though, right? So the enemy's voice, when we mess up, that's often a time that he uses to bring attack. And so even though I'm talking in this little piece here about storms that we caused, I think in some ways that's inextricable from what the enemy tries to get us to do as a result and what tries to get us to believe as a result. There have been many pivotal moments in my life where the attack of the enemy and my own failure threatened to strangle my identity in Jesus. When we agree with the enemy, when we agree with Satan, we submit ourselves to what he says is true about us. So I remember a turning point in my life was when I made a hard decision. I made a decision that instead of wallowing in my shame and spending months recovering my identity from my own failures, I chose to disregard the things that the enemy was shouting about me. I agreed with him in the fact that I was guilty, but what my guilt meant about me or what should be done about it, I gave that to God. He was the one that got to decide. And so I chose not to let shame come into the picture. And not having shame, again, it doesn't mean that I wasn't guilty, but it meant that I was coming to God, I was coming to Jesus in all of my junk, saying, I'm not going to come into this with my own preconceived judgments. I'm not going to come into this with my ideas. I'm here laid bare. What I did is what I did. And I'm asking for your judgment. I'm asking for your words. And the only words I choose to believe about myself is not what the enemy says about me, not what I want to say about me. I am completely committed to hearing what you would say about me. That is the only thing that matters. And when I started doing that, when I started living in that way, it shifted everything for me. Because one, I was able to recover from my failures so much more quickly. It didn't nail my identity in the same way because I stopped echoing and agreeing with the voice of the devil. But two, sin in itself became less enticing and had less power over me. I began to get free from patterns of sin because I wasn't being trapped up in the same cycle anymore. All of a sudden, I was coming to God saying, I'm not going to come and tell you who I am. I'm going to come and ask you who I am. Like, I'm guilty, but now what? What do you say about me? And when I started doing that, patterns and cycles and shame and fear were broken in my life, and identity really began to become rooted and established in me. Storms that I was causing and that were repeating themselves were beginning to just disappear and dissipate. And I want to tell you something powerful. In Zechariah chapter 3, there's this amazing vision, and it says, then he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to oppose him. And the Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is this not a brand plucked from the fire? And it says, now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and was standing before the angel. Then he answered and spoke to those who stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And to him he said, see, I have removed your iniquity from you, and I will clothe you with rich robes. And I said, let them put a clean turban on his head. So they put a clean turban on his head, and they put the clothes on him, and the angel of the Lord stood by. What a powerful picture this is, because Joshua is standing there in this vision, and Satan is standing right there accusing him. And if you read carefully, you recognize that what Satan is accusing him of, it's there. He is wearing filthy rags, and it says the Lord will remove his iniquity from him, which means there was iniquity, right? There was something there that the enemy was pointing at and accusing and pointing out, and it was legitimate. What was not legitimate was the identity that the devil was trying to impose on Joshua. And what I love about this is we look at the character of God, and so often we think, if I come to him with all my junk, if I don't beat myself up first, then he's going to do it a whole lot worse. And so I better, let me soften myself up a little bit with some blows so that when I come before him, I can handle what he's going to say. And here's Joshua standing before God, and instead of God beating him down, he rebukes the devil, the accuser, the attacker, and he says of Joshua, I'm removing your iniquity from you. I'm removing your dirty rags, and I'm replacing it with beauty. Right in the presence of your accuser, I am restoring you to beauty. That's what our daddy does. When we have storms that we've caused, the first thing that we need to do is reestablish our identity with him. We have to come before him and get a revelation of who he says we are, and we have to let him lead us into the next step in the process. I love that passage. That's in Zechariah chapter 3. Now, once I get reestablished in him, I have to go about cleaning up my mess. Sometimes I made a mess with other people or with situations around me. You know, and the thing is, we think, man, I've got such a big mess. What am I going to do about it? When I have my kids clean, whether it's their room or the living room or whatever it is, I'm often right there with them helping pick up. And what's funny is I'm doing two or three times the work that they are. Like, they're like, one thing, what do I do with this? And I'm like, I've got five things in my hand, and I'm, you know. And it's so funny because they'll do their little cleaning thing, and they'll ask, why do I have to pick this up? I didn't play with that, Thomas did. And, you know, they complain while I am in the process of aiding them. What would happen if they could recognize how much more quickly things are getting done because daddy's here helping? What would happen if we, instead of just going to God, like, why, I have so much to clean up, it's such a big mess, what am I supposed to do, where do I put this thing? What if we just recognized and thanked him for the amount that he's involved in that cleanup process, and then we just do what we gotta do, and we can do it with joy because we're not alone in it. You're not alone in it. You may feel like you're alone in it, but you are not alone in your cleanup. We should be. We deserve to be. That's why I hate that word deserve. That's the stupidest word in the English language, deserve. If we lived by what people deserved, nothing in life would be worthwhile. We would all just, like, let's just give up now. If that's how life is going to be done, by what we deserve. He's not that kind of God. We don't deserve his help in the cleanup, but he's there because he's that kind of daddy. And John 14:16, Jesus said, I will pray the Father, and he will give you another helper, that he may abide with you forever, the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him, but you know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. And get this, I love this verse. He says, I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. Get this, guys. Jesus isn't just trying to teach them some good theology. He's not just trying to say, hey, it's okay, I'm going to send the Holy Spirit. He's actually saying, look, I understand that in some of the people he's speaking to have a deep father wounding, have a deep fear of abandonment, and they know that Jesus is leaving. And Jesus right now, in saying that phrase, he is speaking to the most tender, pained part of their heart, and he is trying to affirm with his love a reality that we all need to capture. He will not leave you as an orphan. He will come to us. That is such a tender promise. And when we go through storms that we've caused, reestablishing ourselves in that kind of identity is what's going to help us get to the other side. There's other storms that are storms that the enemy stirs up. There are a spiritual attack. And I want to be clear that there are times to go to war against the enemy. There are times to take up arms and do battle and fight hard. So I don't want to say that I don't believe in that. I'm not digging too deep into that today, because I actually believe that most warfare against the enemy, not all, can you hear me, but most can be won simply in the place of the presence of Jesus and the truth of God. I genuinely believe that a lot of the warfare that we face against the enemy, just like in that picture of Zechariah, can be defeated in the place of the presence of God and the truth of what he says. The devil can't gain a foothold where the truth and the presence of God reside. Satan's biggest weapon against us is our agreement with him. Satan's biggest weapon against us is our agreement with him. With fear or shame, like he is called the deceiver, he's called the liar. And when you submit yourself to agreement with a lie, that's his biggest tool to wrestle us away from God, from his presence, from who we're designed and created and called to be. In Luke 22, Jesus is talking to Peter. He says, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you." So let's capture this. The devil has asked God to sift Simon like wheat, to go after him, to attack him, right? And here's Jesus' response. He says, "I have prayed for you." I think what he prays for is vitally important to understanding God's approach to warfare. What Jesus said he prays for in response to Peter being attacked by Satan is vital to our understanding of God's approach to spiritual warfare. He says, "I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." That our faith would not fail. Sometimes the biggest thing that we can hold on to when we're being attacked by the enemy is our trust that we have a good daddy, and what he says about us is true, and who he says he is true. Our faith in him and our trust in him. Sometimes there are times in life and seasons where the winds are blowing and the storm is coming, and I've talked about this picture before, but in the movie, Twister, there's this amazing scene where they tie themselves to this thing, and the storm's coming, and it's just blowing over them, and if they weren't tethered, they'd be blown away. And sometimes I think the only thing that we can tether ourselves to in the middle of that storm is just the fact that we know who God is, and we refuse to align ourselves with any other point of view, no matter how realistic it seems in that moment. What we can't do in spiritual attack is be passive. You cannot be passive when the enemy is attacking. Storms of the enemy don't often just disappear, but they can go underground. They can appear more subtle and more quiet. I think I may have mentioned this before, I'm not sure, but when I was young, I used to have attacks from demons when I was going to sleep. And as I was going to sleep, I would feel trapped, I would feel immense terror, I would hear voices and laughter, and it was incredibly demonic. And every time, my head was so fogged, I could only think one word. I could think Jesus. And as soon as I thought Jesus, the fog cleared around his name, and I could think just a little bit more, "Jesus, help me," and it would go away. Now, I know now, I've grown enough to know the doors that I opened that allowed that attack to continue ongoing. But it hit a point where at that time, I knew so little, and all I knew was Jesus could help me. That's all I knew was Jesus could help me. And that was what I held to. But there were days and there were moments where I can remember being so tired that I had the thought, maybe I could just live with this. Maybe I'm just tired. Maybe I just live with it, deal with it. And again, in the same way that I could have partnered with the enemy's identity and what he said about me, I could have believed the lie that was something I could never be free from. I could have just said, you know, I could live like this. If this is, it's easier than fighting, maybe I could just live with this. If I had allowed myself to become passive, I genuinely believe that the enemy would have had some pretty deep hooks in me. And I remember being tempted by that. And I made that decision, no, I'm not okay with this. If Jesus can help me, I'm going to keep going after Jesus. But I want to encourage you, some of you may have hit that point where you felt tired. and you said, maybe I could just live with this. And if you did, I'm not saying any of this for you to feel shame if that was a decision that you made. But I do want to encourage you, your passivity then does not have to echo in who you have to be now. We have an opportunity now to break that, to take up arms, to pick up a sword. See, I think the things that we need to get is we need to get identity, we have to get insight from Jesus, and then we have to take authority. We have to get our identity, we have to get revelation, what's going on, Jesus, then we have to take authority. And we say, I'm not okay with this anymore. I may have agreed with this back then, but I am breaking that in Jesus' name. I'm rejecting all ties that I made to that. And we take authority and we fight. The last kind of storm that I think we face is natural storms. And in some ways, natural storms are the most difficult for us to face because you can't just pick out who is to blame. Who do I fight against? Like when a natural storm hits, when somebody passes away or somebody tragically has some kind of sickness or a relationship is devastated and you didn't do anything, you've done everything you could to make that situation right, we can feel powerless. And sometimes we go through the pain that's just the outflowing of living in a fallen world that hasn't fully been made to reflect heaven yet. One of the hardest places to be that I found is when you feel like you've done everything you could, you've done your best, and you're still in that place of storm and pain and trial and suffering. Because the question, I don't know about you guys, but the question for me can always echo back to, this is still somehow my fault. I didn't quite do enough. Like, I did a lot, I fought hard, but maybe there's something I missed, and because there's something I missed, I'm going through this. And I think we have to understand that sometimes we live as though that there's this razor-thin edge, and God is measuring to see if we really did try hard enough. But that's the wrong question, because if we read the Bible, God is much less concerned about why pain happened than he is with what we're going to do about it, with what he's done about it. Jesus never said, you made your bed, now lie in it. And so we have to keep in mind that when natural storms occur, even though we want to blame somebody, we might want to blame ourselves, we have to know that God is not placing us on a scale to weigh our value and that he's not going to leave us alone in it. Those storms that come, the biggest things that we can do is to make sure we don't face it alone, to make sure that we continue to draw nearer than ever to the truth of Jesus and that we pursue his healing in life. We have to process the pain, but we don't have to let ourselves get stuck in the mud. When natural storms come, one of the movies that occurred to me as I was praying through this and writing it was the movie Up. Have you guys seen that? And there's a scene in the very beginning. It's the most powerful 8 minutes of a movie that maybe ever. Like, there's so much emotion, and that happens. And there's one scene where they're planning for a baby, and they're pregnant, and there's a miscarriage. And there's a scene where the wife is sitting in this chair in the front yard, and she's got her face turned up toward the sun. And on her face is this expression of complete peace and release. And if I didn't know any better, I would say it feels as though there's worship on her face. Sometimes the best thing that we can do when we're in those moments of pain is just that. To sit, to process, to let ourselves feel what we're feeling, but to turn our face toward him and just release. I love that scene because I think it expresses what's possible inside of us if we're willing to stop looking for someone to blame and to just let his light shine on us. And sometimes that's all we can do in those moments. If you guys recognize, there's common themes for how we respond to these storms regardless of what's causing them. We've got to know who we are. We've got to know who he is. We've got to get his insight and his input in what's happening inside of us. And then we have to get authority and direction on what we're supposed to do next. At the end of the day, who's responsible for the storm that you're going through? If there's a mess in your life, whether or not it was caused by you, who's responsible? At the end of the day, I think we have to say, I have a responsibility to pick up a mess in my life and invite God into that and ask his help. And like, but if I'm wounded, nobody else can go in and start my healing process for me. If I've gone through a storm and there's stuff all over my front yard, at the end of the day, instead of looking for who to blame, we have to look for who's responsible. And the question who's responsible is not just who do I point the finger at, but it's who's actually going to clean up this mess. Nobody else can even see the mess that's happened inside of me. So nobody else can take responsibility for it. God and me, we got something to work through if there's a mess in me. But it's got to start with my recognizing that there's a mess. Sometimes God is just waiting for us to acknowledge, yeah, there's some stuff in here. And I'm either going through it right now or I went through it and I haven't totally cleaned it all up yet. But he longs to enter into that with us. You're responsible for the mess if it's there inside of you. That doesn't mean that you alone are called to make it right on your own strength. But it does mean we have a responsibility to acknowledge it and to address it in partnership with the Holy Spirit. In Lord of the Rings, one of my all-time favorite movies, Frodo says to Gandalf, "I wish none of this had happened." And Gandalf says, "So do all who see such times, but that's not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that it's given to us." Some of you have gone through things I can't personally process because I can't fathom what it would be like to go through what you've gone through. But I can say the question that we all have to ask is, what are we going to do with it? Romans 8:28 says, "We know all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose." If it's not good, then it's not the end, and you've still got some work to do. And that's okay. It doesn't, listen, his burden is light. The work that we have to do in our own healing process, it does not have to be backbreaking work. It doesn't mean that it's always easy, but you are not carrying the full load of that. Just like when we have our cleanup, God's doing two times, three times, 10 times, 1,000 times the effort that we're putting in. But we've got to do something with it. We've got to bring it to him. And we've got to know that if it's not good yet, it's not the end yet. I think it's actually okay in the middle of a storm to ask God, what are the gifts that you want to give me through this? What, you know, to even in advance, like while you're in the middle of the worst part of the storm, I think it's okay to say, God, how are you going to bless me through this? I love Kath's prayer while she was in pain, just saying, God, how are you going to make this worth it? Because I know there's more. So I want to ask you guys, I guess I want to do two things real quick. First, if you have gone through a storm or you have that, you're trying to get through that healing process, I'd actually like to invite anybody who would like to get prayer right now. And Catherine and I and Keith and Jessica, and we'd love to just kind of take a minute and pray for anybody that could use that right now. And then if you'd like, I'd love to kind of open it up. And if you guys have stories about this, or if this is helpful, or you have questions, or, you know, anything that we want to process together as a group, I'd love to open it up to that too.